Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
You know, we're getting into bad habits here, Matt.
We are, yeah.
Leaving these last minute.
We go through these periods of like being ahead of the curve and getting one, two episodes in the bag, and then we just slip. But I feel like we have an excuse this time, which is Slash New was like right in the middle of our recording schedule.
It was. That was last week, wasn't it?
Was it last week or was it the week before?
See,
it was the week before.
2 weeks ago.
Coming up. I mean, it's Monday, so it's like a week and a half to 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
You missed
and
that.
And you were up there. You were up there for Slash New.
I was, yeah, yeah.
Not just as an attendee.
No, that's right. I actually got up and spoke.
How'd that go?
Interesting, actually. Went pretty well. It was, how did what go? The conference in general or my talk?
Well, first things first. Your talk first, and then we'll get on to the conference.
Okay. So my talk went well, I think. It's the first time I've done this talk. And also, it's the first time I've ever done a fully scripted talk. So it was, you know, normally you have, you know, a bunch of slides, maybe some demos, and you know your material, you know the subject. So you effectively, you know, you might have some cues or some beats you want to hit. But yeah, this was fully scripted. Like I had an auto cue, a teleprompter, and I read it. It was like a speech. It was a proper talk. I did have some slides, but the slides were supplemental. And that is a whole other conversation, actually. I found a major gaping hole in presentation and talk software, which I vibe coded a fix for. I'm going to share soon because I'm pretty really happy with how it turned out, actually.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other thing. So, yeah, so it's the first time I've done that. And by and large, it went quite well. The problem was there was a couple of bits of like audience interaction in there. But I think the problem was is because it was very clearly it was a speech, right? So I was standing there talking like the audience were very engaged, like that, you know, there was I could see like everyone's like faces were, you know, there was no talking, there was no kind of people fiddling with phones or laptops or anything, like everyone was just kind of looking at me. So the engagement was good, but then when I tried to kind of the delivery was quite deadpan as well, like there was humor in there, but it was delivered in a very flat deadpan tone.
Yeah.
So when I kind of tried to step out of that to do interaction with the audience, it just didn't get much in the way of the kind of interaction. You know, you learn. And I think there's a couple of ways I can address that. One is to just cut it, not do that style. The other is to literally break character. So, you know, like I was kind of standing at the podium and reading, and what I could do is like pick up the mic and step away. And then when I'm ready to get back into it, step back. I don't know, like experimentation, that kind of thing. But anyway, that's all delivery. But I mean, the delivery was important because it was a important topic and it's a subject that, you know, sometimes there's different reasons that you do these kind of talks, right? And sometimes it's because you literally just want to do a talk. Sometimes it's because you have something, a technology or something you've learned and you're really enthusiastic to share it. And sometimes it's something that you believe is very important. And that's how I felt. And that's why I wanted to do this talk. The talk was called Everything is Too Hard.
Okay. It's you made me want to sit there and see if I can get a copy of it now.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounds intriguing. It sounds interesting. Like I'm just trying to visualize that experience and being in the audience.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't sound like it's your standard conference talk.
No, I don't think it was.
So yeah, I want to see it now.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was recorded, but maybe I'll do it again.
Yeah.
And we'll see. Yeah. But yeah, very happy with it. There's like, you know, there was one particular slide in there that I really wanted to land. And it, like I said, it was a talk, not a presentation, but there was some slides that were supplementary. But there was one that I kind of really wanted people to, I really wanted to drive a point home. And I thought I saw some people taking pictures. And yep. I actually did see that one slide. Someone had shared a picture of it on LinkedIn. Yep. So I'm pleased to see at least one person. And I also printed a bunch of stickers just for that, you know, with this one thing on this one slide on it. And I printed them all out and I was like, got my little guillotine out and I started cutting them, but all of the ink was running. I don't know what happened there. Like I've used this sticker paper before and it was fine. So yeah, I don't know, but we'll see.
Speaking of stickers, were you able to hand out any stickers?
I handed out heaps of stickers, Beer Driven Dev stickers, obviously.
Yeah. They're the only ones I'm concerned about.
Yeah. Yeah, I handed out a few of those, and I put some on the little welcome table at the organizer's suggestion, permission. So
I guess we should say welcome to anyone that's listening.
Welcome. Welcome to our new listeners.
That's right. New listeners, new stickers, new listeners.
Yeah.
Awesome. So there was a 2-day conference, so I'm sure there is probably too much to go through over the next half hour or so, but what about some highlights?
Yeah. So there was a lot, absolutely too much to go through, but it was a great conference. I mean, I've said this in the past, but like, I really do love /New as a conference. It's got such a great vibe. It's obviously Newcastle was a regional town. It's very different from your major conferences. It's got a community vibe to the whole conference. And there's some great rules. They have this, I've probably spoken about it before, but they have this Pac-Man rule, which is that if you're in a group, a circle of people, and you see someone who isn't, like, you know, bring them in, which is great. But I don't know, it's just got that vibe. Like, everyone who's there is there because they want to be there. People are talking, people are friendly. The talks and the content is always exceptional. And I saw some great talks, which I'll tell you about. But something I thought that was interesting was, so the topic, the theme of the conference this year was Human in the Loop.
Yeah.
And obviously there was a lot of AI content. I specifically planned my 2 days around the non-AI track. And it, you know, that was intentional. So I think, you know, the organizers deliberately ensured that at any given time there was one AI talk and one non-AI talk. So anyone who has AI fatigue can avoid them.
Yeah.
So that was good. But obviously AI was the star of the show because, you know, all these years into AI, it still is.
Yeah.
Of course, now is an interesting time for AI, but let's not talk about that today. But it's all changed now. Anyway, so Liz Fong Jones, who gave the keynote, and the keynote was AI is like chocolate. The short version of that premise is, just because it's delicious, don't put it in every recipe. That's the analogy, and it landed really well. I wrote down some specific things that she said, and I won't relay her entire talk, but some of her choice quotes, which I thought was amazing. She talked about AI psychosis. I don't know if you've heard about this before, but this was one of the original researchers on, I think one of the GPT models was convinced that it was alive. There's a really interesting paper on it. Another quote of hers I wrote down: don't inflict AI on people without their consent. This next one I'll come back to because it's the most important thing she said. I wrote this down, and I wrote down this vague comment, and I was like, I'll remember what this means. Above/below average, put chocolate in baking. It was like, if you're a below average cook, chocolate might improve your baking.
Yep.
But if you're above average cook, you probably don't want to put it in if you don't need it. Something like that. I should look it up. There's a really great chart she showed on AI adoption and AI utilization. And she was talking about how when you look at it like this, it looks great. But then when you factor in the demand substitution, you see that actually the equation changes completely, which I thought was really interesting. And I thought there was another angle to this, which she didn't cover. She was talking about attribution and AI authored commits. They may have been using AI to write report. Yeah, so there was not seeing productivity gains. She's talking about 6 months. The thing that I thought was interesting, and just to play devil's advocate, was that there's tangential benefits. So I think if AI is helping, you know, there's other things that you might be doing because AI is making your job easier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anyway, she was talking about how Claude emits open telemetry. So you as a business can literally see everything that all of your staff, like every message that goes out, all the tokens that go out, all the tokens that come in, you can obviously analyze that and see where there's opportunities for improvement. So anyway, our MCP servers is the sous chef. That was interesting. But yeah, the thing that she said that I wrote down here, which was really interesting, I thought, was influencers like me are under pressure to deliver outsized results. And she elaborated on this and repeated it and drove it home a few times. She said, when you go to talks and conferences and you see all of these amazing things that people are doing with AI, don't forget that it's their job to make it look good. It's their job to do these demos and these polished things.
Yeah, it's a dev role job.
Yeah. And she was just urging everyone to not forget that, which I thought was very interesting. Quick aside, did you see any of the build videos?
None of them.
Same, yeah.
Kept my head in the sand on those ones. Not for any other reason than I just wasn't overly interested this year.
Right. I didn't, because I didn't have time, basically.
Yeah.
But apparently there was some kind of drama with Scott Hanselman and some of the content. I don't know.
Oh, I didn't say that.
No, I don't know what any of that's about.
And now you got me intrigued.
Yeah, I might be misreading the situation. I don't, as I said, I didn't see any of it, and I don't know what any of this is about.
When was Bill? Bill was it last week?
Last week, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a busy week for me, especially weekend.
Yeah, yeah. You don't have to talk about that.
No, it's just been busy.
Yeah.
Just life.
Okay, so that was basically the keynote. Now, I won't go through every talk, but I did see this great talk by Simone Bennett from BuildKite.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, effectively, it was, what was it called? It was called From Delivery to Assembly Line. And it's basically about automation and all of the things that we all say that we're supposed to be doing. And, you know, she wasn't really talking about AI, but she was, because it was about like guardrails and making sure that AI delivery is safe. And she made the really good point that none of the, like, you know, anyone that's worried about how do we govern AI, like, what are the guardrails? How do we make it safe? It's like, well, we already have all those things. And it's really pushing people to do the things that we said that we've been doing for, you know, decades, but we don't really. Like, you know, all of the good coding practices, the repeatability, the safety checks in our CI, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's really, really interesting. And, you know, she talked about how at where she is, what the work that they do is they've made everything repeatable, they've made everything automated, so on and so forth. And she says she sometimes hears this argument where people say, oh, you know, but all of our projects are unique and, you know, every customer is different. And she made the really good point, which is that that's just basically complete bullshit. It's like 80% of what you do is identical across all of your projects. 15% that's different should be configurable. So you have all the same pieces, but you configure them differently. And it's that last 5% that's unique. And that's the bit that's interesting. And that's the bit where you should actually be focusing your effort. So make the rest of it repeatable and configurable and redeployable and focus where it matters.
100%.
That was the premise of her talk. And so she said she made a few interesting points. Like, you know, as I said, these are like, it wasn't new lessons, but it was new perspective on it. And one of the things that she talked about was codifying your guardrails. And she said that if your checks, but not just your checks, the rules themselves are codified, then you can automate correction, not just validation.
Automate correction, not just validation.
Which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
So that was cool. I wrote down this quote verbatim. If you can't define what good looks like, you're not going to have a good time trying to automate it. That's true, especially around testing. This one always comes up. Can we automate the tests? Yep. What tests do you want to automate?
The ones I'm meant to do?
I was hoping that automation would absolve me of the responsibility of having to define tests. Well, sorry, buddy. And it was interesting. I wrote this down myself, and this is not something she said, but just what occurred to me, and it's what I just said, is that the only thing that changes is the substrate, right? You know, like all of these things that we're now saying are rules for AI and governing AI, they're the same things that we've supposed to have been doing already.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think if we look at it from the lens that AI is, I guess, in air quotes, helping in productivity.
Yeah.
Therefore, we are being more productive.
Yeah.
Therefore, we're moving at a rapid pace.
Yeah.
Which means that those guardrails are far more important.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah.
Right. And I guess the way another analogy there is, you know, a single person dev shop doesn't need the same guardrails, doesn't require the same guardrails that, you know, a 20 person or a, you know, 200 team enterprise shop does.
I would argue they need more, but this is a whole other conversation.
Okay.
I mean, when I'm working on a team, I have people to do code reviews with and bounce things off and to approve my PRs and call out the mistakes that I'm making. When I'm working on my own, I've got only myself to rely on. And as I have learned the hard way, I'm terrible at that.
Yeah, I get it.
Anyway, last thing from this talk, because this one was really, really interesting, and I absolutely loved this. She was talking about this idea of AI adoption and enterprises that are slow to adopt versus enterprises that are not, right? Basically, you know, ones that are pioneering and embracing it and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, so she often speaks to these CTOs or CIOs or CEOs, and they're like, we're not doing AI. Like, we don't have AI in our company. Because we're not ready for it, we don't approve of it, what have you. And she made a really interesting point. She's like, yes, you do. You don't get to decide that. She's like, I guarantee, and I wrote this down again verbatim, I guarantee you your employees are using their own cash to pay for AI. And you know what it reminded me of? And I think, I can't remember if I said it to her or I said it to someone else, but it reminds me 15 years ago when we used to go to tech conferences, maybe not in the dev space, more infra. Maybe you had these conversations, but we, you know, 10 to 15 years ago, we'd go to these conferences and the hallway conversations would be, are you doing BYOD? Is your company doing BYOD?
Mm.
And it was completely the wrong question to ask because you didn't get to decide that, right?
Yeah.
The correct question was, what are you doing about BYOD?
Yeah.
Because unless you've got metal detectors, right, at the door,
yeah,
people are bringing their devices, right?
And plugging them into your network.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's the same thing, right? You know, like, this is the thing, is like AI adoption, either you can control it or you can not control it, but either you're not stopping it.
Yeah.
Really interesting. And she's right. Like, you know, I know plenty of people that are, you know, paying for their own subscriptions for different AI services and using them for work.
Yeah, so do I. I guess the other thing too is because teams or organizations, rightfully or wrongfully, are also very restrictive in what it can, or the amount of information that it's accessing, or even the models that they're using.
Yeah.
People still don't use the ones that the organization's providing.
No. Well,
and so,
yeah.
So, you know, like, the argument being, or not the argument, but the discussion point being, right, you don't obviously don't want to put corporate secrets onto a public model that's training against your data.
Yeah.
But if it's not implemented properly internally and your employees can't actually get the answers they want internally using the internally accessible tools, then they're just going to go to their free version of ChatGPT and throw those questions in with your corporate data.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've seen that happen. I've seen it happen, like you said, where people are just going out on their own dime and doing their own stuff too.
Yeah, because everything is too hard and things are frustrating, and something that makes it easier, people are just going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I wrote this down as well, verbatim from Simone: humans take the path of least resistance. And what's really interesting about that is that I found that a lot of people, including myself at this conference, were circulating this same concept, this same idea. So there's that one. There's a few other things which maybe we'll get to.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll get to. But yeah, really interesting. And by the way, I mentioned earlier about the sticker that I printed out.
Yeah.
The slide was, because the talk was about how everything's too hard. And ostensibly, it's about, I think we should stop treating difficulty as a badge of honor and start admitting when things should be easier than they are. Like Git was one of the examples, right?
Yeah.
It's like, if you say that Git is too hard, you're a noob. You're an idiot. You just got to get better at it. It's like...
And we've covered this.
Yeah, exactly. We have. Yeah. I used other examples as well. SQL. In fact, all of the examples I've used except Azure were from, well, not from, but, you know, similar to concepts we've done. I spoke about JavaScript. I spoke about SQL and the relational model. I also spoke about Azure. And I was just saying that, you know, the problem is that, like, when these things are too hard, it's not actually, you're not the problem. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to say something is too hard. And not only that, is from a it's a systemic issue, right? Because if something is too hard, then that means it's not getting done properly. And the quote that I specifically put on screen that I then printed on stickers was, if the default path is not the safe path, then your system is unsafe by design.
Absolutely. Again, we've spoken about this, right? The pit of success.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, I see this all the time. And I mean, my wife and my kids know, like, this is one of the biggest bugbears that I have. Like, one of the biggest things that I complain about whenever I'm using an app on my phone or whatever else.
Yeah.
And something's not obvious.
Yeah.
Like, it really, really gets, it frustrates me.
Yeah.
Like, one of the things, I don't know about you, but the KO app, the, you know, sports streaming app on my phone.
Yeah.
Is absolutely atrocious. And things are just not obvious in it, and just the UX is terrible. And if I, like, yeah, I mean, I'm not an uneducated user. I kind of know what I'm doing. But if it's not obvious straight out of the box, like, is that my fault or is it really the design's fault?
I think you know the answer.
Yeah, I know. It's me, but...
No, not at all. I mean, like, this is the thing. Again, it's like... In UX, we've accepted, in fact, this is in my talk, right? In every discipline, nearly except tech, we've accepted this, right? Like, I gave examples about, one examples I gave about was a hydraulic press, how mm-hmm. It's got two buttons that are a meter apart, and you have to press both at the same time for it to activate.
Mm.
So you cannot press one with your hand accidentally in the machine.
Yep.
I spoke about kickbacks on chainsaws. Anyway, from a UX perspective, we've kind of acknowledged and accepted that if you want to retain users and you want to grow users, you've got to make it easy.
Yep.
Because every element of friction is a lost customer.
And I'm pretty sure I've spoken about this in the past, but I always remember the example of what they call, what's referred to as a Norman door.
Yeah.
Right? If the door needs to have a sign on it that says push, maybe don't stick a handle on there that someone's automatically going to try and pull.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's ways that you can handle it from a UX perspective that you don't actually need to have the big word push to say this door needs to be pushed.
Yeah.
Just get rid of the handle and people are not going to try and pull it. They're just going to push it automatically.
Yeah. Didn't you say the experiment was that it was a push door and they put a sign on it that said push, but they also had the handle and they found that people still tried to pull it?
No, it wasn't an experiment. It was,
it was the observation about the...
It was just an observation that there was this one door that everyone would be pulling when they were meant to be pushing it.
Yeah.
And the professor
even though it said push.
Yeah. And the professor that was there, like that's where it comes from, the Norman door, like that was his name or something. So the professor that was observing it is like, that's just shit UX.
Yeah.
It's not the fault, not the fact that it's poorly labeled or that people are idiots. It's a UX issue.
Yeah.
And like you said, like, anyway, I don't even know how.
I mean, it's a heuristic that we all have. I mean, yeah, you've covered this before.
And it's just one of those things that like things don't have to be that hard.
No, because everything is too hard.
Well, sorry, things shouldn't be that hard.
Yeah.
But they are. And I think not without seeing your talk, it's not just that they are, but it's that we have accepted that they are.
Yeah.
And it annoys me. Not a lot of things annoy me, but that does.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah. Also annoys me when I don't let you finish what you were saying.
I finished.
Oh, you did?
That was all I had to say on that one. Yeah.
Okay.
I was gonna tell you my next highlight, which was the lunchtime, the WITH panel, which is Women in Technology Hunter. And it was a live panel discussion with Teresa Payne, Carolyn Breeze, who gave the keynote last year, Margarita Studert, Dr. Jacqueline Bailey, and Victoria Aspden, who also gave a talk, which I went to on the second day. That was fantastic. You know, I wrote down a lot during that talk. I was quite blown away, actually. So, and again, like in terms of circling the same ideas, Teresa Payne, I wrote this down verbatim. She said, it's okay to say I don't understand. There was a fantastic story from Jackie as well, actually, Dr. Jacqueline Bailey. She was talking about how earlier in her career, she was in one of the old IT departments when they're in the basement.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of people talking about how to tackle this problem. And she kind of knew the solution. And every time she tried to speak, someone would cut her off or talk over her or they'd ignore her. And her boss at one point like got fed up of it. He just reached into his bag and pulled out an air horn and everyone kind of stopped and looked at him and like went silent. He said, next time someone cuts her off, I'm blowing this thing. And they're like, oh yeah, of course. No, we won't. Of course not. No, we'd love to hear what she has to say. It took about 30 seconds for him to blow the horn after they started talking again. The biggest mystery, of course, is who carries around a freaking air horn in their bag. Well, but no, I'm thinking of investing in one now.
No, I think it's just telling. Because obviously it was either, and neither of us were there, so we don't know, but either he had noticed this going on for a while and he had had enough and he's like, this is how I'm going to solve the problem.
Yeah.
Or she had approached him and said, hey, this is starting to bother me. Either way, he did something about it.
Yes.
And I think, he proactively did something about it. It wasn't just, I carry an air horn around. It was, I have thought about this and this is just shit and we're going to fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm tempted to invest in one.
I mean, these days you could just do it with just vibe code up a loud noise button.
Yeah, you could do that. But I have found myself accidentally.
Sorry, what was that? Sorry. I just wanted to mention that it's rude when people cut you off midway through what you were saying.
Are you finished?
Yeah.
So that was a fantastic discussion and like a really, really inspiring conversation, actually. And I won't go through all of it. There was an observation that I made when they were talking about imposter syndrome, and it's something I hadn't thought of before. And it's very obvious when you think about it, but I had this, and this ties in actually to a talk that came a bit later on. I'm just checking to see so it was later on that day, which I'll talk about next, but I wish I could remember the context. I should have written down more. But my observation was that confidence is not the absence of doubt. It's the willingness to tackle the unknown. Just in the context of imposter syndrome, right? So you don't have to have no doubt to be confident. You just have to be willing to tackle what you don't know and be willing to be flexible and adapt to it. And then in terms of like, because the absence of doubt is arrogance, right? Because this is the next thing I wrote down, which is that when the doubt goes, you need to ask yourself which side of the Dunning-Kruger curve you're on.
Yep.
I think doubt is a very reassuring feeling.
I don't disagree there. But I think to me, imposter syndrome's just got an extra level.
Yeah.
And I think the part, and maybe it's coming from the consulting or even like the speaking side of things, it's the fear of being found out.
But if you've got nothing to hide, then you've got nothing to fear being found out about. So just be open about your doubts. Have I told you about the biggest fuck up in my career? I'm sure I've mentioned it before, at least once.
Was this when you came to Australia?
Yeah. No, it wasn't actually.
No,
it was when I was working at the hospital and I'd written a script to automatically disable accounts in Active Directory that hadn't been logged in for more than 6 months.
You might have mentioned this in the past.
I'm sure I have. So I have my own little test domain and I developed the script in there, tested it in there. It was all fine. I tested it extensively, did reports, ran like what if versions of it. It was, I tested it extensively and it had passed all the tests. It had been through change approval. I didn't cowboy this. Mm-hmm. I actually to this day don't know what went wrong. I can't remember. I can't remember what I did wrong, but it was something obvious, I think. Anyway, so it was a Monday morning. Around 10:30, 11 a.m. and I ran this script for the first time. Mm-hmm. It was running on a scheduled task, but I just ran it for the first time, having tested it extensively, having had a version that just produced the reports and said this is what's gonna happen, not without actually doing anything. And over the course of the next few, I basically found myself getting locked out. And over the course of the next few minutes, it became apparent that other people were starting to get locked out. And then the help desk phones started going. Like basically, I had disabled every single account in the domain, including mine, including the admin, and all the computers started to lock, including the ones in operating theatres with like patients on the table. And yes, that was terrifying. Like I've made mistakes and I have fucked things up.
Yeah.
But this was like fucking terrifying. Anyway. What I did was I went and told someone, someone more senior than me, not someone that knew that technology, not someone that was an expert in it, not someone who I reported to, but just someone who was more senior than me, a lot more experienced than me. And I went and said, fuck. And he just approached it calmly and methodically and talked me through it, which was what helped. And I think that, my first instinct was to try and fix it, and hide it, right? Quickly, not hide it, but I generally find if you break something, you fix it. And then you say, look, I broke it, but it's fixed, right? So that was my instinct to try and rapidly. And as soon as it became clear that I was basically paralyzed, there was nothing I could do. If I had tried to hide it, I would have been fucked. And basically going to someone and asking for help and saying, I don't know what to do. I am scared. I've done something really bad. What do we do? Was the best thing that I could have done. And he talked me through it and we came up with a very sensible solution, which he coached me, right? So he asked me questions and through him asking me those questions, we came to the answer. And the obvious answer was I'd only disabled accounts in the domain. So the enterprise admin accounts in the forest were still active. So I called one of the admins from the forest, the enterprise admin, and explained what had happened. Said, can you please just immediately enable my account, which he did. And I logged back in, I changed disable in the script to enable and ran it and everything started coming back online.
Yeah.
The whole incident, which felt like a lifetime, it turned out was from start to finish 13 minutes.
But time goes slow when shit's hitting the fan.
When there are patients with their torso open on an operating table, yes.
Yeah.
There's a long-winded way of saying that the imposter syndrome is only there if you're being an imposter. When you stop pretending and you say, actually, I don't know this. And I said that Theresa Payne said, it's okay to say, I don't understand.
Yep.
You don't have to know everything. You're not expected to know everything. And the other thing as well, we've heard this before, but when there's one person who says, I'm sorry, I don't understand. Could you explain this? There's at least 10 other people who are relieved that someone asked.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in a big group or in a public forum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, where I thought this led on to, what I thought was really interesting, was later on in the afternoon, there was a talk by Maria Pedicetti, which was Why Brilliant People Struggle to Be Heard. And this is a really fantastic talk. And it was, what was really interesting is she framed it as, this is the advice that I wish I had been given 15 years ago. And it was really interesting because it all tracked, like, absolutely. She's talking about how smart people, technical people, fail to engage with non-technical stakeholders and leaders, and what the typical thing goes wrong. And it's, you know, I know I'm guilty of every single one of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Like she talks about, like, when you over-explain, she mm-hmm. said, basically you're not demonstrating expertise, you're transferring anxiety.
Yeah.
She said, you know, an expert explains, a trusted advisor helps decide. You know, and I'm really, like, summarizing here. She said, when the CEO asks, how's the platform migration going? What they actually mean is, do I need to be worried? They're yep. not asking for an explanation. They're not asking for what you're waiting to find out. They're not asking for what's going well. You don't need to hedge. They're not even asking for detail. They don't want to know anything other than, is there anything I need to worry about here? Is there anything specifically that needs to be escalated to me?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause if not, keep it to your fucking self.
Yep.
Which are, you know, really interesting.
I like that.
She spoke about her 5 rules. Lead with the outcome. You know, what changed for the business? So her tactic for that is, if this were a news headline, what would it say? Which I thought was a really interesting approach. Advise, don't report. Tell them what you think, not what you did.
I think I did this.
What do you think is the situation and the scenario? Like, they don't care what was done or what needs to be done. They do care what needs to be done. But, you know, they don't care about, I fixed this, I built that. It's, here's what I think you need to do.
Yeah. It's more outcomes based.
Yeah.
Right. Now that something's happened,
now that
we've done something, what's next? Like, what does that mean for us?
Yeah.
Or what does now that I've done something, what does it mean for you? You don't care what I've done. You just care what it means for you.
Yes. Yeah. I just flipped over my page and what I actually wrote down here was, stop saying, here's what happened. Start saying, here's what I do.
Yeah.
And I've spoken about this before. One of the fundamental rules of rhetoric is detachment. So it's not like, this is what you should do, here's what I think you should do. It's, here's what I'd do. I don't care. Like, it's you do what you do you kind of thing, right?
Yep.
She spoke about, why does this go wrong for people? She spoke about the empathy pride split. There's a really interesting, again, verbatim quote. She said, when you don't go into detail, you're not hiding your competence, you're proving it. Yeah, competent people don't need to go into the detail. You don't need to give them the breakdown of all your heroics. You just need to say, I fixed it, it's working.
Mm-hmm.
Make people feel smart, not stupid. There was a story that she gave, actually, about how a junior she'd foreshadowed this a bit. She'd mentioned that she used the phrase rolling your eyes, and she told this story. And she said she had an audience of a CFO, CEO, I don't know, whoever else. And she had a senior engineer on her team, and they were presenting. And someone, the CEO or the CFO, asked a question, and everything was going well. And this guy rolled his eyes before answering. And that was it. They lost them.
Yep.
Which was interesting. She spoke about watch your face, feel your face. She said you'll feel yourself do it before you know that you've done it, and you won't intend to. I think that there's a good tactic there that she didn't mention, which is about recovery, which is lean into it. So if someone asked me a question like that and I rolled my eyes, I would sort of probably have a moment of panic thinking, shit, I've just, like, belittled them. But I would probably recover it by saying, oh my God, you have no idea. Yeah, I tripped over that same thing. And it would be true.
Yeah, no, I get that. I guess to me, that just shows a level of self-awareness and mindfulness that not everyone has.
Yeah, but it can be learned.
It can be learned. And it's one of those things that in those situations, you need to really reflect and
what's the word?
Yeah, like you need to, even after the meetings and after these sessions, you have that retrospective.
Yeah.
And even if it's a personal internal one, what could I have done better? Like, where did I really fuck up? Did that actually happen?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because in the moment, you know, people probably don't realize that they're doing it.
Yeah.
And it's just becoming more aware, of your personal tics and twitches and whatnot. That, yeah, it's, and maybe, I don't know, like having someone that you trust to just be able to tap you on the shoulder and just say, hey, you're doing it again.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. There was a story about a help desk technician that was one of the smartest people and just had no awareness of the way that she was speaking to people.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of thing. But there was, I'll just wrap this one up because there was a couple of things that she said. Like she was talking about how sometimes it doesn't matter what you do. There are just people that are just not going to listen. And there are just some people, some groups of people, some scenarios where it's just not the right one for you. And I'll summarize this whole point where she said, don't fight to be heard. Find the room that listens.
Find the room that listens.
Yeah. And she's talking about sometimes you're in a place where people just aren't going to listen to you and there's just nothing you can do about it. And instead of fighting, every time you fight to be heard, you're just diminishing yourself that little bit more. Find a different room. And I've lived that. I've been in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all have. But anyway, the last anecdote that she gave, which was just a fantastic story, right? She's talking about how she had this client and this client owned a small retail chain and he had a POS outage. And it was something that I think they had warned about and been trying to resolve. And it happened. And he was down across all his stores, couldn't take any payments for 4 hours. He lost basically a day of trade. And she fixed it and she got it back online and she went to meet with him. And she sat down and I can't remember the exact phrasing and exactly what she said, but effectively, he didn't care about what the problem with the system was. He didn't care about what she'd done to fix it. He didn't care about how smart she was. He wanted to know. He was terrified. Like she said that he was almost in tears. Like he thought that his business was over, right?
Yeah.
And she took the time. She made the effort to understand him, understand what his concern was. And she just told him this isn't going to happen again. That's it. I can't remember whether she explained how or why, but she said something like, we can do more to prevent it happening. But what we've done immediately is we've set things up so that if that happens again, we'll get you back online within an hour or less.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's been done. I guarantee it. Right. And, he was almost in tears with relief and he immediately wrote her a check for all of the amount of, all of the rest of the work that she needed to do.
Yep.
And the phrase that she used was, I didn't tell him what I did. I listened. And she said, smart didn't get me the check. Empathy did.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I thought was great. Now, another talk that I saw, which was fantastic, that I really loved was stop rolling out, start bringing people along for human questions every team needs to answer. This was by Dan Godden. So Dan is in change management. And as you know, I gave a talk about a similar topic. You may have forgotten.
Yep. No.
So I caught up with him afterwards and we had a bit of a chat about it. It was fantastic. Like he really painted the human angle about what he did. I think he was talking about Salesforce maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a real story about this woman called Thea. And I don't know if that was her real name. But in fact, I'm sure it wasn't. But he was talking about how he spent a lot of time sitting with her and listening to her and how she handled the calls and how she handled the customers. I won't reiterate his whole talk, but it was just, fantastic how he kind of explained the cost of what happens with these big changes. And she didn't understand why they were getting a new system or why they were doing quote unquote rollout. She didn't care. She just, all she knows is that she can't listen as well as she used to, and she can't solve problems as well as she used to. And she said, he used this phrase as like, every time you, he said, can I help you learn this? And she angrily said, you can, but I'm just letting you know, every time you guys do this, things get worse. Yeah, it was really, really good talk. I was just overwhelmed. There was just so much in there. One thing I did think, and I wrote this down, this was my own thought, and I must ping him and ask him about this, is I wonder if one thing that strikes me as missing is a shift left for change mentality. So I think, we spend, and this, I guess, ties into what I was saying, I guess, which is we spend so much time and effort on trying to win people over. Whereas if we, when I say shift left, I mean the engagement, the point at which we start engaging with the frontline workers, with the end users, if we shift that left in the process, do it before we make the technology selection choices, then we buy the engagement and not sell the solutions, I guess. But yeah, there was just so much, there's just too much to go over here. There's a few anecdotes that I thought were great, right? So he was talking about this salesman and he was talking about how they've got these sales people and they're on the road and they're constantly out there, meeting with clients, doing what they do, making sales, making leads and opportunities and stuff. And they'd given him all these iPads and this guy was not using it. And when he sat with him and he eventually found out that basically the guy, it wasn't that he was a Luddite, but he just couldn't type and it was hard to use. He's like doing this hunt and peck typing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact is it makes him feel incompetent. And this is a guy who is actually exceptional at his job. He was the top salesman, but he just wasn't using this tool because it just wasn't the right tool.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it comes down to. Anyway, I wrote this down, right? And this was really, really interesting. And he said, the biggest fear of every employee in your organization, especially those over 45, is being made obsolete.
Yeah, can't disagree with that at all.
That was interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that before at all.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I've been waffling on a bit.
No, sorry. I was just like, on that point, right? I think that's more relevant now than ever.
Well, I mean, that was...
But that doesn't mean it's never been relevant.
No, absolutely. So first of all, that was his point, right? His point was exactly that,
right?
That with AI in particular, you know, that is more relevant than ever. But also, yes, it's never not been the case. Mm. You know, like, especially anytime that there's change, anytime that there's process change, not even technology change, people fear that this is getting more efficient. Am I needed anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Is this here to get rid of me? Really interesting. Really interesting. And you're right that it's not new. And we've spoken about that before as well. We've spoken about the fourth industrial revolution and so many great talks. And I guess I've been talking for a long while and I haven't even gotten to day two yet. But like day two, I'll just tell you a couple of highlights. So obviously change is only good when measured. Fadila's talk, phenomenal, as we've mentioned before. We got to see the first time she ever did that.
Yeah. First time she ever spoke.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, spoke in public.
Yes. Yes. I caught up with her a bit and had a bit of chat. She was loving the conference as well. So great to catch up with her actually. And open invitation if she ever wants to come and join us on the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everything is too hard at 1 PM. So one of the other talks that I saw that I thought was interesting and it was really interesting to see a kind of different perspective was how to make good decisions. So this was by Victoria Aspden, and it was really interesting seeing her perspective on this, given that year one of AdaConf was effectively a whole day of that,
that very topic.
And this was a fantastic talk, and it was much more pragmatic. It was more methodology. It was, this is how you make good decisions, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, this is the step-by-step process. Obviously what we saw at AdaConf was amazing, and it was more kind of philosophical and theoretical. This was practical. This was... do this, do this, do this. So, you know, she's got her steps, her recipe for doing it, the five steps. So it was like, understand the problem. And she spoke about frameworks that she uses. So Six Sigma, the six thinking hats and the five whys.
Mm-hmm.
Step two, ensure that all groups of people are represented. Another quote that I wrote down verbatim, a business does not exist to have perfect technology, which was great. It was like, you know, again, in terms of technology choices and choices you're making around technology. Be clear who the decision makers are. Four, oh, I love this one. So present the facts and the trade-offs. And this is a quote that I wrote down verbatim, was there is nothing wrong with a good old table. She's talking about like a lot of the tools and a lot of the visualizations people use. Yeah. She's like, this is my go-to. It's a table. It was fantastic. But the thing I wrote down that was amazing, I'd never heard this term before. Maybe you have, data debt.
Haven't come across tech debt.
Yeah. So she's talking about, it is what it sounds like, right? So it's like, if you've got bad data, it's like, okay, you can build off it, but just like tech debt, it accrues interest and it compounds and it gets worse.
And you know what? I reckon it's even worse than tech debt.
Yes, I would agree. Yeah.
Because you just collect so much because data is cheap.
Well,
it's cheap to store. It's cheap to collect, right?
Yeah.
It's not cheap to process. It's not cheap to organize. It's not cheap to make sense of, but it's cheap to accrue.
Yes.
And it's easy. And the problem is when you are accruing it and you're not actually processing it and making sense of it and making sure you're not just collecting crap, you can get snowed under very quickly and very easily.
Well, that's the thing, right? It's like you do accumulate it and it is cheap to acquire. And I think if you think about tech debt, right? Technical debt. It's like, okay, we've made this decision. This is going to make it, we tend to talk about tech debt in the context of this is going to make it harder to change the longer we leave it.
Yep.
And it's going to have a ripple effect and it's going to make other things harder to change, right? But you can always say, but at least the data is good, right? So we'll come back later. We'll refactor this. We'll rebuild that. We'll replace the other. At least the data is good.
Right? Yep.
With data debt, right? If the data is bad, it means that all the data that's based on it is also bad, and that compounds and accrues interest. Mm. Right. So the longer you leave that, eventually you get to a point where you're in a hole so deep you can't dig yourself out of it. Like, it doesn't matter how much you rebuilding, refactoring you do, like, your data is irrevocably corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
So I would also argue it's arguably more important, and it's not a term I've come across before, and it's something I'm definitely keen to look into more.
Oh, it is, and I think, I mean, like you're familiar right now or in the past with like phrases like garbage in, garbage out. Right?
Yeah.
And you're seeing it a lot now, especially in the AI space where it's like, I have, here's my shit data and yeah. here's my shit data with AI sprinkled on top, but it's still shit data.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So I think it's becoming more obvious now, but it's always been a problem.
I agree. Yeah. Yeah. It's the same. It's a recurring theme, right? Which is the problems aren't new. They're just,
no.
And in fact, do you remember, did I send you the article I wrote, which was, if AI is not delivering value, this is probably why.
Look, either you didn't send it or I just didn't read it.
Right. Okay.
Doesn't ring a bell.
Okay.
I'm going to say you didn't send it.
Maybe I didn't send it. This was on the Orinco blog, but I'll send you a link and you can have a look at it. Essentially, it was, and this is actually evidence-based. So I did the research and I found the studies that back this, right? But the point is that a lot of money and time and effort is being invested into AI transformation projects.
Yep.
And a lot of it is leading to disappointment and frustrated CFOs, right? They're mm-hmm. asking about where are the returns? And almost invariably, the projects that are failing to deliver are the ones where they're basically trying to use AI to quote unquote cut costs. And I say quote unquote because in corporate speak, cut costs is a euphemism for labor reduction.
Yeah.
So the investments and the projects, the initiatives where they're trying to use AI to replace people are not universally failing, but overwhelmingly failing. And there are some use cases where you can automate an entire business function. And I have seen those projects, but they are not the norm, right? What's working really well is when individuals are being given AI and being empowered to use it to figure out for themselves how they can yes. do their jobs better. And that's why, you know, the investment that you should be putting into AI is into the guardrails, as we've spoken about, AI safety, AI governance, making sure that everyone is empowered, making sure that everyone has the right tools so they're not doing shadow AI,
mm-hmm.
And then let people do better with it. And the point is that AI is a multiplier.
Yeah.
Whatever you give it, it multiplies. And if you let people use it to multiply their work and you multiply good work, you get a multiple, right? Yeah. But the garbage in, garbage out is it's not just garbage in, garbage out. It's a multiplier. So you get 10x garbage.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, look, I've spoken a fair bit about AI and I didn't even really attend the AI side yeah. of the conference. But, you know, the theme being human in the loop, it kind of is essentially that theme.
Yeah, I get that. And actually, what I was going to say, just to tie it back too, is like that other saying that people are saying at the moment is, right, it's not that AI is coming to take your job. It's someone that's going to use AI is taking your job.
Yeah.
Right? It's, like you said, it's a tool.
Yeah.
And the theme of human in the loop really reiterates that fact that you still need the human there.
Yeah.
You need the human to be using that tool. And yes, it is a multiplier. That's what I was trying to get my head around before is, yes, it is a multiplier, but it's a multiplier of that human. If there's no human, then you're multiplying nothing. Or as you said, you're multiplying garbage. We all know what multiplying nothing is.
One, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe if you go to school in the UK.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I get that. And I think I like that theme of keeping the human in the loop, because I think we now, like as an industry, are starting, or not just an industry, but we are now, civilization is starting to realize, okay, well, yes, AI is an awesome tool, but we still do need to keep those humans in the loop, because at the end of the day, it is still just a tool.
Yes. And this is a topic for another episode, but the industry is starting to realize that, and it's starting to change the shape of what we're seeing in terms of where AI is going. That's a whole other conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm keen to talk about it.
Yep.
But maybe not today, because not I think today. That's the last orders bell.
I am well past bedtime.
Yeah. Well, that's my very, very brief whistle stop recap of Slash New. And once again, it's a shame you missed it. It really was good, actually. Really.
Absolutely love to. Maybe next year.
I'm starting to think I've had a lot of days on recently, and I don't know if I can do it anymore. But yeah, maybe next year. Because I think you're going to miss AdaConf as well, aren't you?
I don't want to, but at this rate, I think I might be.
Yeah. I've already got my ticket. Everything, flights, accommodation, ticket, sure. Everything.
Yeah, well, I'm not that organized.
I don't fuck about. Actually, quick aside, I was chatting to Wixie a fair bit.
Yeah.
/new. He was asking about AdaConf. He's like, man, you and Liam go on about that a lot. Like, you guys really love it. Like, is it really that good? Like, maybe I should go. And I was like, yes, it is. And yes, you should.
Oh, well, at least we know someone's listening.
Yeah. Actually, at one point I was standing on a table where I was just following up on some work emails and I was eating some lunch and this guy came over and he's like, oh, do you mind if I, you know, stand here and eat? And I was like, yeah, not at all. Go for it. And we started chatting and he looked at my name badge and he was like, oh, I thought I recognized that voice. You're the Beer-Driven Devs guy. It's like, yeah.
That's yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, that was cool. So people are listening, people, apparently.
Well, look, you know what? I want people to just let us know they're listening.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
I reckon if you saw Matt up at /new, if you got a sticker from him, let us know. I'd love to hear it.
How do people let us know, Liam?
Oh, look, I can give you my phone number if you want, or you can use Carrier Pigeon.
Yep. Smoke signals.
Smoke signals works.
So leave a comment on posts on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, I think, is probably the best one. But even on Spotify, Apple.
Yep. Oh, yeah, we've had comments on Spotify before.
Right. Spotify, Apple comments, LinkedIn comments, reach out to Matt,
myself. I don't
think
Apple lets you do comments.
Don't they?
No. We looked into this before.
Okay.
But Spotify. I don't use LinkedIn. Head on over to www.beerdriven.dev. You can't leave a comment there, but we should change that.
Well, that whole thing needs a change.
It does. I'm working on that, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'll have to send you the new design I'm working on.
Oh, shit. Where do you find the time?
I make the time.
You need to do this as a talk, how to make time. You know what? I know we're trying to tie it up, but you remind me of Scott Hanselman.
Do I?
Yeah. In the fact that you seem to be able to eke out like 30 hours out of every day and 8 days in every week.
Yeah.
Just everything you say you're doing, I'm like, how the fuck are you able to do that?
I have no downtime and I don't sleep and I'm working myself to an early grade. No, I mean, I don't know. It's, I guess I'm just like, I'm motivated and, you know, if I want to do something, I just do it.
No, I think they're absolutely kicking me out now, Matt.
Dragging, I would say, kicking and screaming.
I'm kicking and screaming now. So thanks for giving us that recap on /new. I really disappointed that I didn't get to go up there and really hoping next year that I'll be able to join you up there.
That'd be awesome. Yeah.
But I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs, Matt. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Or I think the best way would be just to leave a message.
Where would people leave a message?
Where do we host it these days?
So we're on www.
I mean, leave a comment. Yeah. I mean, that's how tired I am. Leave a message.
Yeah.